what I'm going to do today is something which should be interesting on a couple of different levels. It's still connected to Purim, but let me preface it by saying the following. When we started at the beginning of the year studying Agadah, I tried to explain what Agadah is. I don't know if you remember, but I totally avoided any kind of interpretation or explanation, or introduction for that matter, to what it really is. So for some people, if you were to ask them, what is Agadah, including opening up books, articles, they would say Agadah is the part of the Talmud which is not law. So therefore, they'll continue to say that the Talmud is divided into two different parts, the legal parts and then the non-legal parts. The legal parts, what do you want to call the legal discourse or back and forth, is the halachic discussions. And then you have the Agadah, which is the non-halachic discussions. Now, I like the interpretation, but it's superficial. And very often when things are superficial, they're actually also not completely correct. In this example as well, it's not really true, it's not really correct that that's what Agadah is, as we're about to see and we're about to explore. Because today we're going to look at a case where you have a brief halacha being taught, and then you have a story afterwards. But then we're going to end up being stuck somewhat, trying to figure out what is the interrelationship between the story, the Agadah, and the halacha? Which means, essentially, do I say, oh, I just look at the halacha and I ignore the story? Or does the story modify? Does it contradict? Does it agree with? So therefore, in this case, or let me put it this way, what happens when you have an Agadah, a story, that talks about something which is halacha? So then, do I go back to my definition that Agadah are the stories and non-halacha? So that definition doesn't really work. But as I said, this will have everything to do with Purim, and specifically for what some people is the most exciting part of Purim, and that is getting drunk. So, first, the halacha statement. This is a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Zayin Amud Bet. It says as follows, Amar Rava. Now, I'm already stopping. It's my very strong suspicion that this is not a coincidence that Rava is being mentioned. And I will agree that I did not necessarily figure this out by myself, other than at some point having my interest tweaked and trying to figure something out. And this is what I figured out, because I did spend a whole day at one point looking up every single statement I can find where Rava is mentioned, which, by the way, is a really absurd thing to do, because Rava is one of the most popular people in the Talmud. And in case that wasn't good enough or complicated enough, also, there's going to be another problem that there are two different people, one named Rava and one named Rabba. Rava is spelled Resh Bet Aleph. Rabba is spelled Resh Bet He. And there's also confusion between the two of them. In this case, incidentally, we're going to have the statement is by Rava, but the story is about Rabba. And I can assure you that in manuscripts, there is very often confusion between the two, that sometimes it gets messed up. Are we talking about Rava or talking about Rabba? Now, let's go back and talk about Rava again. Rava, for whatever reason, is all over the Purim story, which means you don't realize this unless you pay attention when you're learning the Gemara of Megillah, and you read line after line, page after page, and then you notice something, you go, oh, Rava keeps on speaking. Okay, I'm going to say something now, which I hope does not come off as arrogant as it could come off. I've learned through Daf Yomi a number of times, right? So Daf Yomi means you see the entire Talmud. Sometimes when I'm learning, I'm not looking to what it says because I've already seen that. So sometimes I'm looking to keep in mind other things. So for example, which conversations, and this is what goes into my head, which conversations are taking place in Israel, which conversations are taking place in Bavel, which conversations are taking place in the 2nd century, which are in the 3rd century. I'm just trying to see things from a little bit of a different level. And another thing that I really try to pay attention to are people. Meaning to get a feel for a person. What did this person say so I can get a really consistent understanding of who that person is? One of the things in my new book on Agadah is that I have various chapters on people. And when I was doing that, I was trying to figure out what were all of their teachings. So I can tell you about Rava, two things that are interesting. And once you know the two things that are interesting, then this statement is going to become almost obvious that it's Rava. One is that he talks a lot about wine. in lots of different places, you're going to find Rava somehow connected in stories about wine. Some of them interesting and some of them really interesting. And that's the really interesting ones, which I won't tell you, unless you want me to. Probably the most interesting one is, it says as follows, that he was working in the Beit Din. Now, Rava, if you don't know this, I don't know if there's any reason you should, very often you have rabbis that have colleagues that they argue with all the time. Rava's argument colleague was Abaye. So it's always Rava and Abaye. 3rd century Amorayim, Bavel, always Rav and Abaye. Abaye died. Abaye's wife, now I don't know how to put this delicately, apparently she was really hot. And Abaye was her third husband. When Abaye died, she came over to the court, and this is the context of the Gemara, was discussing a woman's right to the estate and various things, needs that she may have, and then the question was, what about her drinking bill? How much wine should she be supported with from the estate? Because look, just let's go with this for a second, that aside from any kind of inheritance, tufa, whatever, she also had rights to the estate for all of her basic needs. Now the question is, and you could tell me your opinion, is wine a basic need? So that was part of the background of the discussion. So Abaye's wife comes in and she says, what about my drinking bill? And Rava says, what are you talking about? You were married to Abaye, and Abaye didn't drink. There should not have been any kind of drinking bill. So she says, what are you talking about? He used to provide me with a cup, and then she says that was this big. Now, the Gemara then says, when she says this big, then her sleeve sort of went up her arm, and the Gemara says that he sees a part of her body that was normally covered. It doesn't go into terrible details, but it does say, you're probably thinking, what does this woman even look like? It said that when she lifted her arm, it was like light came into the room. I don't know. That in this discussion about wine, that Rava then gets so worked up that he runs home, and then he drags his wife into the bedroom. And she looks at him and says, Rava, what happened at work today? You know, like, who was there in your courtroom? So he says that she was there, and he says her name, and then it says that Rava's wife goes chasing down Abaye's widow with, like, trying to beat her and say, you stay away from my husband, and so on. You've already killed 3 husbands. Do you want to kill another one? So again, is wine really part of that story? It's a little bit, but I'm just going to say there are dozens of stories about Rava and wine, and there's dozens of stories of Rava interpreting the Purim story. So for this statement then to be Rava talking about drinking is going to be of no great shock to me. Now, before I read any further, he's going to tell us that you have to drink on Purim. That's where this all comes from. Part of what's really interesting about that is, why didn't the Mishnah say it? Which means, I told you, he's 3rd century. Which means we have a whole bunch of centuries or generations of Tanayim. It's not there. You go all the way back, Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, you go further, you know, Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, and so on, all the way through the Tanaim, Rabbi Yudah Nasi, all the way through the Tanaim, there's no discussion on drinking on Purim. It's only when we get to, not even Rav and Shmuel, we go all the way to Rava, we find the first time saying, oh yeah, a person should drink on Purim. So I want to stop for a second and give a little bit more context. I want you to think a second. The rabbis decided that we're going to celebrate Purim. The rabbis decided, it's not a Torah holiday. When the rabbis decided to make up the holiday, what do you include or what do you not include? Again, just think for a second, you know, from the very beginning. What is the model that we have of holidays? You have Shabbat, you have Chag. Both of those have something in common. You don't work, you're not allowed to do milacha. Chag, you can do more l'malachot. Chag, you're allowed to cook. Shabbat, you can't cook. Chag, you're allowed to carry. Shabbat, you can't carry. So therefore, when you're going to make up a rabbinic holiday, what do you make up? Now, just in case you're going to say, well, rabbinic holidays by definition mean, well, they don't by definition mean anything. Because, for example, the rabbis had a second day of Chag. Second day of Chag is exactly like the first day of Chag. And they made up, you can't do milacha, you can't do work. So, and what does Shabbat have? What does Chag have? So all of them have the same kind of things. Total cessation of work. Now, the rabbis made up a holiday called Purim. They did not make a cessation of work. That's interesting. What else did they do? They said it's more like a regular weekday. But there's one obligation. The one obligation, well, a couple. One obligation you have is to read the Megillah. So you read a text. Okay, good. Good. You read the story. Okay, good. Another is about giving the gifts and so on. Also good. But the third, but the fourth really element of it, because it's Mishloach Manot and Matanot Le'avinim, but the fourth element is you have a seuda, you have a meal. Now, right there, incidentally, it's very different from Shabbat. Shabbat, you have a meal Friday night, you have another meal Shabbat morning, and maybe even a third meal on Shabbat. During Chag, you have a meal at night, you have another meal in the morning. You say Kiddush at night, you say Kiddush in the morning. So over here, you have Purim, only one meal, and no Kiddush. So it's possible that this idea of drinking on Purim comes back. Again, I'm going to give you two different directions. Comes back to a simple point, is that we want to make something festive or quasi-festive, somewhat festive. So there's no real Kiddush. Why isn't there Kiddush? Because the day is not Kadosh, right? Should I say that again? Because it really should be obvious. There is some kind of a... There's no Kiddush because the day is not Kadosh. You're allowed to do work. You're allowed to do malachas. So you can't have Kiddush. So there's no... Nonetheless, you drink wine. Nonetheless, a wine should be part of the meal. Nonetheless, it should be part of the festive meal. On Chag, we say, Ein simcha ele bavasar of l'yayin. They're part of a celebration. So this is a celebration. So maybe there's wine on that level. That's point number one. Second point, specific Purim point, you cannot divorce wine from the Purim story. It's like practically every single part of the story is punctuated by wine. The story, and that's the word mishte, means to drink wine. Even as we pointed out, Vashti was somebody who drunk, connected to wine. The story begins, the whole thing begins, because he's drinking. He has one party, he has a second party, she has a party. When Esther wants to try to solve the problem, she makes a party, and all these are drinking parties. Haman's downfall becomes because of drinking, which means it's almost to say that I can't celebrate Purim without recognizing that the entire Purim story is somehow about drinking. So therefore, maybe all that Rava is doing over here is articulating there needs to be some kind of a festive wine celebratory element. And by the way, it's interesting, both Rashi and the Rambam stress that the drinking on Purim needs to be wine and not other things. Why? Because it's wine specifically which is mentioned in the story. But now I'm going to read what Rava actually said. And what Rava actually said is terribly disturbing and terribly difficult. And the only thing more difficult will be the story that happens right afterwards. Amar Rava. Rava said, Michayev Inish, or Michayev Inshe, a person is obligated, Michayev Inish, this is Aramaic, Livsume Bipuria, part of the difficulty is translating the word Livsume. I've seen the various English translations will render it as become mellow or to become intoxicated. There's a huge difference between the two. Livsume, Rashi writes, I believe, lishtakir b'yayin, to get drunk with wine. People who are a little cynical have pointed out to me, oh, because Rashi sold wine. There's actually absolutely no evidence that Rashi sold wine. Rashi grew up in an area that they made wine, they raised grapes and or so on, but there's no evidence that's how he particularly made his living. Amar Rava, mechayev inish livsume bepuria, a person's obligated to drink wine on Purim, and again, how much drinking I'm leaving out right now, because I have to explain the next phrase, ad delo yada, until the person doesn't know, bein, between, baruch Mordechai, that Mordechai should be blessed, la'orer Haman, and that Haman should be cursed. Now, if you want to help me, you'll volunteer to help me. Judging from your perpetual silence, I have a suspicion you're not going to help me all that much. What happens after a person has their first drink? So that's an unfair question, because it depends who the person is, it depends what they drink, it depends how much they drink, it depends what they ate beforehand. So obviously there's all kinds of elements involved. So one drink, what does one drink do for you? So one drink probably will make somebody maybe smile a little bit more, maybe feel a little bit more chilled. What does the second drink do? Or what does the third drink do? Or what is the fourth or the fifth or the sixth? So the various stages of drinking, and by the way, those of you who know nothing about this can look it up on the internet, because the internet knows everything, and you can find out what drinking can do for you. But why are you laughing? Okay. So at some point, you know what happens when somebody drinks? I'll tell you what happens at some point. At some point, everything is funny. Just everything is funny. Why? Well, part of what drinking does is it takes away inhibitions. Also, what drinking can do at some point is it can also affect fine coordination and fine motor skills. By the way, a little more drinking can also affect gross motor skills, which is why they'll have you try to work you know, walk a straight line and so on, but that's much later on in terms of the gross motor skills. Drinking could take, could impact judgment, but can, I don't know, could somebody really get to the point that they don't know the difference between that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed? Have you ever met somebody who drunk so much who just really couldn't figure it out if Hitler was the good guy or the bad guy? How in the world could, meaning, what I'm saying is, I don't understand the Gemara. I don't, yes, we can make poor choices. Yes, we can have confusion. How can you ever possibly get to this? And by the way, if you can get to the point that you no longer know if Mordechai is good or Mordechai is bad, if Haman is good, if Haman is bad, again, you now are in total confusion between Mother Teresa and Hitler. You all realize that at that point, there are probably a whole bunch of really bad decisions that you'll make as well. So how in the world can the Torah, which is telling us all kinds of value judgments, this is good, this is not good, this is something which you should do, this is something you shouldn't do, how in the world are you supposed to remember, if you're that drunk, what you're allowed to eat and what you're not allowed to eat, what's good and what's bad, what's kosher, what's not kosher? How are you supposed to remember who you should sleep with or who you're not allowed to sleep with if you no longer know what's good and what's bad? But my point is, how can the Torah possibly encourage us, the phrase that actually some use, is to get as drunk as Lot. And when Lot got as drunk as Lot, he ended up sleeping with his daughters. So how in the world can the Torah tell us, yeah, this is a really good thing to do. We advise this. We support this. Yes?
Is it not metaphoric?
Oh, if it's metaphoric, then everything's easy. But then what does the metaphor mean? So I agree with you. We have to work a little bit harder to figure out what this means. But my point was, and I agree completely, my point is if you take this at face value, you're essentially dealing with something which sounds as if it's absolutely absurd and therefore impossible. Because I don't believe a person can get that drunk. And if a person can get that drunk, I can't believe that Rava is saying, yeah, I think this is a good idea. Forget about his wife beating somebody else. His wife would have chased him down and beaten him if he got that drunk. Point taken? Anybody disagree with me and say, no, I think getting that drunk is really a good thing? Again, I can't understand this. And if this isn't good enough, then we get to the story. Now, here is our Agadah. Rabba v'Rebbe Zeira. So Rabba and Rebbe Zeira are also two well-known rabbis. Rabba and Rebbe Zeira are actually live a little bit before Rava. Would there have been interaction? There could have been, but Rava's later. Rabbi Reb Zeira, Avdu Sudat Purim Bahade Hadadi. Rabba and Reb Zeira, and by the way, the names are actually funny. You don't get it, but the names are actually very funny in this. You got to the last chapter in my book or no? Just 1 second. Okay. Still reading the other ones. So the last chapter in my new book is about Rebbe Zeira. So one of the things that we know about Rebbe Zeira, and there you have in this article everything you want to know about Rebbe Zeira and more. Rebbe Zeira, we don't even know if it's his real name. The word Zeira, was Zeira in Aramaic, means small or short. He was actually a very, very little man. Rabba means big. So actually the names here are very funny. You have Rabba and Rebbe Zeira, one who's very big and one is very small, but just that's just their names, and you have to kind of wonder if there's some kind of a subtext to all of this. Rabba and Rebbe Zeira, Avdu Sudat Purim Bahadi Hadadi. By the way, okay, I'll translate. Rabba and Rebbe Zeira did the Purim Suda together, Bahadi Hadadi, with one another. So this is in Rebbe Zeira's earlier years. He grew up in Bavel. He ended up moving to Israel. He was the guy, in case you ever heard of this, who fasted to forget all the Torah he learned in Bavel in order to start all over again when he came to Israel. He's like the biggest Zionist in the Talmud. His rabbi used to tell him that you're not allowed to leave Bavel and move to Israel, so he would hide from his rabbi so he wouldn't have to listen to him. And then he ran away and he came to Eretz Israel. You'll have to read that last chapter. It's the one article in the book that I only taught this once. Everything else that I taught lots and lots of times, but the Rebbe Zeira article I only taught once. It was the occasion of the 30th anniversary of our moving to Israel, is when I gave the Rebbe Zeira class. So Rebbe Zeira is a very interesting person, but Rebbe Zeira is, again, at this point, he's still in Bavel, he's still living there, and Rabba and him have Purim together. Maybe this is one of the reasons he runs away, by the way. What happens next? It says then, Batar de Ibsum. Now, I want, again, Chayvan of Lufsume, I'm going to translate it here as intoxicated. After, batar means after. Baba kama is the first baba. Baba mitzi is the medium one. Baba batra is the last one. Baba batra, batar, always means the end. Batar, after, the ibsum, that they became intoxicated. Kam rabba, rabba got up, vishachte l'rabzera. And he performed an act of shchita. You know what shchita is? Ritual slaughter on ribzera. Now, just in case you're wondering, that sort of sounds like he takes a shechita knife and he slits his throat. Lamachar, the next day, Barachme, Rabba prayed for him, Aleh for him, Fachye, and he brought him back to life. Lashana, the next year, Amarle, he said to him, we don't know who said to whom, Leite mar v'navid sudapurim b'hadi adade, come, sir, let's do Purim again together. Amarle, he responded, Lav kol shat v'shat mitrachesh nisa. Miracles don't happen every single day. So now, needless to say, this is a very disturbing story. Before we get to the primary question, does the story support Rava's contention? You should drink on Purim till you don't know the difference between good and evil. Oh, look, Rabban Reb Zera did it. He didn't know the difference between good and evil. He took out a knife and he killed Reb Zera. So this supports it. Or would you say, no, that's not what the Gemara is doing. The Gemara is telling you, no, don't drink, because you may take out a knife, and may kill somebody, and therefore, did this story disprove the contention of Rava that you're supposed to drink on Purim? Or maybe it's modifying it. Maybe it's saying, oh, we see that this is what people do, they drink on Purim, but don't go this far, because that's a little bit too much. And I can assure you right now, all of the commentaries that discuss this will take one of those three approaches. Either it supports it, or it rejects it, or it modifies it. But nobody ignores it, by the way. They all have to see it together, because, again, that's why I had difficulty by saying, oh, what in the world does an Agadah have to do with Halakha? Well, in this case, it has everything to do with it. Based on how I understand the Agadah, will then determine on what I conclude in terms of the Halakha. But there's so much information over here that I don't really know where to begin with all this. First of all, the last thing that I had referenced was, I don't know who invited the other back for the following year. My guess is that Rabba invited Reb Zera and said, listen, all's well, right? Ends well. In the end, it all worked out. And Reb Zera is shaking his head and saying, no, I am not having Purim with you. You are not a safe drinker, right? This was bad enough what happened last year. I am not getting, right? I'm not getting in a car with you. I am not having Purim with you. And I want a metal detector if I ever get near you, because if you had a drink and you have a knife, you're trouble. By the way, there's one interpretation that the Chatam Sofer mentions from one of his teachers, the Hafla of Pinchas Alevi Horowitz, who says that they were obviously, again, this is not obvious to everybody, they were obviously discussing the Gemara. The Gemara says, what happens if you take a knife and you make it red hot and then you do shechita with it? Does the sharpness kill the animal, or does the heat kill the animal? If the sharpness kills the animal, then the animal's kosher. If the heat burns the animal's not kosher. So if you look in the Gemara in Chulin, it says, Rabbi Zeira says that the sharpness gets before the heat. So he says, how does he know this? So obviously that's what they were discussing. They were arguing back and forth, sharpness, heat. So Rabbi says, I'll prove it to you. He takes the knife, and Shechs Rabbi Zeira, when he brings it back to life, he goes, no, it was really the sharpness and not the heat. Now, I don't know if you love that interpretation or not. The Chatam Sofer liked it. But I'll tell you a different interpretation that maybe you'll like a little bit better. And that is interpretation of the Maharsha. He starts off by saying, please do not take this literally. He doesn't say those many words. But he says, what does it mean that they shechted? Now, when somebody today wants to say that they got totally drunk, what would be a euphemism that they would use instead of the word drunk? They got...
Trashed.
Good. Now, can you imagine somebody who doesn't know... That's perfect. Can you imagine somebody who doesn't know that much English, like an Israeli walking by, I got trashed, and they're thinking, wow, they're putting them in the garbage? Like they're trying to understand. Or someone said, I got hammered, and they're imagining somebody's hitting them with a hammer or something. And he goes, oh, my head hurts, I got hammered last night. Oh my God, like what happened to you? Which means, like, whenever you take euphemisms, what?
Like no one says that anymore.
You don't get around enough. Anyway.
Sorry.
Hammered. Well, it's funny that early, what did you use back in the day? Okay, we won't pick on you. So again, you could choose your own euphemism. So the Maharsha claims, he goes, no, that they drunk together and he shechted him. He forced him to drink more than he normally would, because shechita takes place in the throat and drinking takes place, it goes down your throat. So therefore, this is just a euphemism. Now, on the one hand, some of you will like this. Why? Because then you get to avoid the whole, you know, little part about a man dying, and first of all, killing him, and secondly, bringing him back to life, which are all going to be, you know, we're going to have to suspend our disbelief in order to be able to, you know, to get to those places. On the other hand, I would ask the Marsha, if he were sitting here, can you show me one other instance that the phrase that he shechted him means forcing someone to drink? If you can show me one other usage of that, then I would feel a little better. Because when you say got trashed, I'm sure you would be able to show me, in terms of literature, in terms of television and movies, you would be able, if you worked hard enough, bringing me 10, 20, 50 different examples where that phrase is used. And yes, you can even find hammered, you can find within contemporary usage, which means it's a term which is used. But in order for the Marsha to be convincing, I'm just making a point in terms of methodology, for his explanation to be convincing, I understand why he wants to avoid the literal read of it and say it's a metaphor, but still you have to be convincing in your methodology and interpretation. So again, that's what I would need in order to be more convinced. By the way, there's another great Gemara, which is really important if you ever considered Judaism's attitude towards astrology. So I want to say one sentence about this. Judaism's attitude towards astrology was far more enthusiastic before the Rambam. The Rambam basically threw it away and said, this is like the silliest, you know, thing imaginable. The Talmud talks about it. I mean, the Rambam will have a hard time with those passages. A matter of fact, the Gemara says that somebody who's born under the star or under the influence of Mars. Now, anybody know in Hebrew how you say Mars? Which itself is really interesting. What color is Mars? Wow. Mars is a red planet. So Mars was called in Hebrew, is called in Hebrew, Ma'adim. So the Gemara says anybody born under Ma'adim is going to have a predisposition to spilling blood. But now the Gemara makes a comment. That is not going to be predetermination whether you will be good or bad. It says you can be a bank robber or you can be a mohel, right? Do circumcision. You could be somebody, again, who does negative things. You can be a butcher, which means you're going to be good with a knife. Whether you use this for good purposes or bad purposes, that's where free will comes in. But the Gemara does understand that somebody born under Mars, which is red, will end up having this involvement of spilling blood. So now the question will you be a surgeon and save people's lives? Or will you be somebody who will, you know, use a knife in order to hurt people? So that's what the Gemara says. Rabbah, our hero from the story here, finds him in that Gemara and says, what are you talking about? I'm born under Ma'adim. And like, I don't go killing people. So some of the commentaries point out, yeah, that must have happened before he pulled a knife in Reb Zerah, which is also really interesting. It means that he had this predisposition. He always apparently was in control. It never came to the fore until he actually had a little too much to drink. And then suddenly this predisposition comes out and now he's pulling a knife and he is performing shechita on Reb Zerah. So that's also something which is interesting over here and maybe also part of the problem. So I'm going to say it again. So what is the interrelationship between the story and between the halacha? So essentially it'll go something like this. The vast majority of halacha discourse are people who are either saying the story disproves Rava's contention you should drink on Purim to that much, or it's saying that you should limit the drinking because look what happens if you drink too much. In the early authorities, I don't know if you can find anybody who'll say, yes, you need to drink to the point of total confusion, because again, most of them will point out, if you drink to the point of Lot, you'll end up behaving like Lot, and Lot did not behave very nicely. And that's till you get to the Kabbalistic writers. Once you get there, you know, all hell breaks loose. So, for example, in one comment about reincarnation, it's Rava was actually a reincarnation of Lot. And that's where some of all of this is coming from. So I'm going to leave the more Kabbalistic, because the more Kabbalistic will tell you you should drink. If I have time as we move on, I'll come back and try to explain it. But first, let me try to deal with a couple of other elements of this. One of the most elegant interpretations is one which is quoted by a number of Rishonim and Achronim. I don't know who was the first one to say it, but a lot of people quote it, so a lot of people like it. And they say, what does it say? You should drink till you don't know the difference between Mordechai is blessed and Haman is cursed. Now, when I said it the first time, I interpreted it. Yes? What was my interpretation? You should drink to the point that you get confused and you don't know, you know, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. So I'm going to give you at least three different interpretations that don't understand it the way that I just now said it. One, this is not the most elegant one. I'll tell you that in a second. One, Tosfot says there used to be a song they would sing, and the refrain of the song sometimes was Baruch Mordechai, and sometimes was Arur Haman, so you drink to the point that you don't remember which refrain you're supposed to drink, which is not all that much drinking, by the way. You could drink a little bit, and now you no longer you know what you're supposed to say at that particular point. That's what Tosfot said. What's interesting on Tosfot is what he's telling you is, no, you don't. It never said drink to the point you don't know the difference between good and evil. That's not what it means. Drink to the point that you get confused when people are singing together. Again, huge difference between the two. But the one that I wanted to tell you that I thought was elegant was one which is based on something which most of you will hate. And so you'll be thinking, so why would I say it if you're going to hate it? Because I like it. And if any of you like it afterwards, you'll have to tell me so that I don't think that all of you hate it. Now, one of the things that we always hate is gematria. The reason we hate gematria is because you kind of get the sense you can make anything, can make anything, and so on. The other reason we hate gematria is because it's based on math. So who here is really good at math? Okay, who here is a calculator? Okay, so here we go. So here's what was pointed out. We have two words, Baruch Mordechai. So let us do together the math. You can write this all down as you do this. Baruch Mordechai. Bet is 2. Resh is 200, Vav is 6, Kaf is 20. So what's that? 228. Mordechai, continue to add, Mordechai, Mem is 40, Resh, again, is 200, Dalet is 4, Kaf is 20, Yud is 10. What are we up to altogether? 502. Baruch Mordechai equals 502. So you have to drink so you don't know the difference between Baruch Mordechai, which is 502, and Arur Haman. Let's start with Arur Haman now. Aleph is 1, Resh is 200, Vav is 6, Resh again is 200, that's Arur. Haman is, He is 5, Mem is 40, Nun is 50. So what does Arur Haman work out to? Also 502. You have to drink enough that you can't do that math in your head. I think most of you are already on that level, which means you don't have to drink anymore on Purim. So I don't know. I like that a lot because it is so random that those two words, those two pairs of words should actually have the exact same meaning. So Rav is saying, no, you drink on Purim until you can't do the math in your head. Now, I think there should be a deeper level to this. I mean, that's really my problem. I think it's really cute that Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai work out to the same 502, but maybe there should be a deeper idea behind this. By the way, did any of you like that or no? Not at all. Yeah, a little. It's 5 little. Nothing.
Well, they have the same.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's what I said. It's so. The Vilna Gaon, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, says, "You drink on Purim, and then you contemplate two things. One is Baruch Mordechai, that Mordechai is blessed." And the second thing you contemplate on is Arur Haman, that Haman is cursed. And he says you should think about this and try to figure out what is the real miracle of Purim. So let me explain what he means by this. Is the real miracle, okay, let me go back a step. In this world, we don't always see the hand of God. And by the way, specifically in the story of Purim, we don't see the hand of God unless you start to look very carefully. As opposed to the 5 books of Moshe, as opposed to the entire Navi, God does not appear in the book. Which means God doesn't say, do this, don't do this, fix this. Total silence. By the way, that's a really important point that we have to come back to. There's no word of God in the book of Esther. nonetheless, at the end of the book, what ends up happening? Mordechai ends up being elevated, and Haman ends up, you know, losing and being killed. So what you have over here is a happy ending where God's fingerprints are all over it. But now the question is, in life, what is more significant to you? The fact that good gets rewarded, or the fact that evil gets punished? So the Vilna Gaon felt that that was the meditation of Purim. The meditation should be, is the greater miracle on Purim that evil finally gets squashed, or is the greater miracle of Purim that good finally gets rewarded? And he says that's what you think about on Purim, which means you drink on Purim ad lo yada, until you're not really sure what is more significant, Bain, Baruch Mordechai lo or Haman. Which means, again, he never said you drink to the point that you don't know if Hitler was the good guy or the bad guy. He says, no. You drink to the point that you're not sure what's more important, what is more significant, that God rewards the good or God punishes the bad, which then just completely took this whole text and turned it into something else, really much more of again, a meditation of understanding what it is, the miracle of Purim, what it is that God accomplished over here. And again, this serves as some type of a precursor to the end of days, where God will be involved in history, and God will reward the good, and God will punish evil, which takes place. And therefore, this whole Purim story becomes something which is, again, far more important, and not just, oh, it happens to be, the miracle of Purim is that a Jewish girl won a beauty contest. Again, it becomes much, much more than that. I don't respond to anything I say, you notice this? Okay. So, let's go back, and I want to try this again. One of the words in the sentence is yada. You have to drink until you don't know. Ad lo yada. Till you no longer know. Ad lo yada. So I just want to, again, what I'm doing now is really echoing certain writers, the Sfat Emet and Rav Tzaddok, other Hasidic writers, who are noting over here the word yada. And the word yada will be interesting to them for the following reason. And this is what I was originally thinking about talking about today, but I'll talk about tomorrow, and that is the connection between Haman and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The Gemara asks, how do you ever know there would be a guy like Haman? So it says, Hamin ha'etz, where Adam and Eve had just now eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So I have to pause there for a second, because if we're going to go full Hasidic now, we need to really understand what's at stake and what's going on. There are many different opinions in the Gemara what exactly was the tree of knowledge and good and evil. The Zohar's opinion, again going more Kabbalistic, the Zohar's opinion, it's a tree which causes confusion between good and evil. What kind of fruit does that? What kind of tree does that? The answer is, it is grapes. That the tree of knowledge of good and evil was grapes, it was a vine, and it's the kind of fruit that when you drink from that fruit, it causes that confusion. Again, this is the Garden of Eden. Garden of Eden probably had unbelievable grapes. Adam and Eve take those grapes, squeeze those grapes, put them in a glass, which according to some, the whole sin was drinking too early, drinking on Friday instead of waiting for Shabbat, but they drink this and now there's a world of confusion. Let me explain this in a deeper level. Prior to eating from the fruits of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, there was a Yetzer Hara in the world. There was an evil inclination. How do I know that? Because Adam and Eve sin. You only sin because you have an evil inclination. But what's the difference between the world prior to eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil to afterwards? So if you ever want to research this or read about this or learn about this, this is really the topic of the first two chapters of the Guide for Perplexed, of the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim. And essentially what he ends up saying is that man was born with a capacity, knows this is good, this is evil, and then to make choices, which one I want to do. But the difference between afterwards, instead of this stimulus being external, it becomes internal. What's the difference between internal? When it's internal, I can then get confused between what is good and what is evil. Let me try to restate this. There are some things that all of us end up doing which we know are wrong. What made us do things which are wrong, we can't help ourselves. We can't control ourselves. But there are some things that we do which are wrong, which are far worse than that, and far more dangerous than that. You know what that is? Those are the things that we do that are wrong that we convince ourselves are really right. I always think the most dangerous people are the people who think they're doing a mitzvah and are actually doing something which is devastating. Which means, meaning somebody knows they're doing something wrong, you can call them on it and say, you know, listen, that's really wrong what you did. Yeah, I know, I got carried away and whatever. But the person who thinks they're doing a mitzvah when they're doing something which is wrong, that's the person who's, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to say to them? That was wrong. What are you talking about? That was wrong. That was so great. They're the ones who are going to justify it, which means there's two levels of the justification. The first level of the justification is when you do it, you convince yourself that you're right. And then someone calls you on it and say, what are you talking about? Of course, this was a great thing that I did. On top of all that, you know what else happens? You never do tshuva for it. Why do you never do tshuva? Because when Yom Kippur comes around, you start going through your head all the bad things that you've done. That's not one of them, because you already convinced yourself it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. So the things that we do when we have confused, our inner world confuses what's good or bad, those are the most dangerous things that we end up doing. And again, that is this ability to justify. So again, what's explained then is that prior to the sin of eating from the tree of good and evil, the knowledge of Tov V'ra, of good and evil, prior, there was clarity. This is good, this is evil. And note something, Eve still went for the evil. She knew, but what happened? She just saw all the beauty in it. Sometimes something which is really bad looks beautiful, and it looks so beautiful, so then, you know, you go for it. Now, what did the serpent actually say? The serpent said, if you eat this, you'll become like a god who will know good and evil. It's really interesting, then, the analogy between the Nachash and Haman, saying he's connected to this tree. Haman also saw himself as a god. He made people bow down to him, which means this ability to get that confused into thinking that you are God is something which is actually remarkable. So now, this sin is good and evil are confused, and that's the world that we live in. So now, what if I were to tell you that the real meaning of this text is you're obligated to drink on Purim, which means go back to the sin of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Go back to that point, right? They sinned, going to the Zohar, with the grapes, and now they cause confusion. Use grapes, adeloyada, till the point that you're no longer impacted from the Eitz Hadaat Tov V'Ra, adeloyada, Bein Baruch Mordechai Lo Haman, you're no longer impacted by this confusion of the world between what's good and what's bad, between Tov V'Ra. So it says that's more or less the way the Sfat Emet is going to be reading this text. And again, what he did was, I think, a radical read of it, but he took everything and sees it much more as thematic and representative rather than in any way taking it literally. Yeah. Again, I'm going to back it up and explain it as I read it. Purim is a time, going back to the Vilna Gaon, Purim is a time that finally gets some clarity because the good gets rewarded and the evil gets punished. Now, let's go further back to the point that good and evil get confused in the first place. So, you're obligated to drink on Purim until you're no longer impacted by yeda, by knowledge, tree of knowledge of good and evil, adelo yada bein baruch mordechai l'racham, between tov v'ra, which means you're no longer in a world of confusion. That means you drink. Now, by the way, that's very funny. The reason why it's so funny is, how do you drink? How do you drink to achieve clarity? Because all of you would say you don't drink for clarity, you drink for confusion. So how in the world did you drink? But he's talking about a process, and his process is undoing the sin that took place in the Garden of Eden, and that's the way that he's reading all of this. So let me try this again. You know, if you think again about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, one of the most preposterous things about the sin that took place there, and again, if you're going to ask me why am I there, I'm there because the Gemara told me to go there, because it told me that Haman is connected to the Nachash, that Haman is connected to that tree. What was the big mistake that we made in Garden of Eden? It wasn't that we ate from that tree. The big mistake that we made was that we didn't eat from the other tree. What was the other tree? The other tree was the Eitz HaChayim. Just think for a second. One tree is a tree of life. The other tree is a tree of death. I know that they package it better, because if you say it's a tree of death, who's going to have it? No, it's not a tree of death. It's a tree of knowledge of good and evil, but if you eat it, you're going to die. by the way, even worse than death, if you eat it, you're going to get confusion. And confusion will end up leading to death. If you understand where did death come from, you're going to confuse good and evil. When you confuse good and evil, you're going to do things that you think are good or really evil, and next thing you know, you've entered a world of death. But there was another tree over there. And what was the other tree? The other tree was the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. Now, according to the book of Mishle, Torah is the tree of life. Eitz Chaim hi l'machzikim ba. You know, we saw in the other class, in the class on the Parsha last week, that the first time we find the Kruvim, we're guarding the path to the Eitz Chaim, guarding the path to the Tree of Life. And then in the Mishkan, where are the Kruvim put? They're put guarding, as it were, the Aron, which has the Luchot, has the Torah inside, which means the Eitz Chaim is Torah, which is clarity. Now, here is the challenge of Purim. The challenge of Purim, it's a world of confusion. Why is it a world of confusion? Because God doesn't speak. So I want to phrase it this way. Purim is the time that the Jewish people grew up. And I want to explain this in a way that all of you understand me. What is the job of a rabbi? Okay, I don't have an easy answer for that. Rabbi Soloveitchik quoted his a relative of his, actually Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan, who the university is named after. Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan asked his father was the Netziv, he asked him, what's the job of his uncle was the Netziv. Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan asked his father, who was the Aruch HaShulchan, wrote a book on halacha, what is the job of a rabbi? He said, the job of a rabbi is to give rulings, to give rulings on Jewish law. He asked his uncle, who was Rosh Yeshiva, the Netziv, and he said to the Netziv, you know, what is the obligation of a rabbi? He said, the obligation of a rabbi is to be Rosh Yeshiva, to teach Torah. He then asked another relative, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, what's the job of a rabbi? And Reb Chaim said, the job of a rabbi is to take care of the widows and the orphans, to take care of all of the people that society does not look after, and all the rest is like icing on the cake. If you have time to teach Torah, you have time to do other things. It's essentially the job of a rabbi is to implement the rules of the Torah and to take care of the disenfranchised. That's more or less what he said when he asked. So I'm going to ask all over again. So what is the job of a rabbi? So if you're talking about in the teacher mode, so I can ask again. So what's the job of a teacher? So let me put it like this. Some rabbis, their goal in life is to have as many followers as possible and make them as dependent as possible. In my mind, that's completely twisted. The job of a rabbi is to make themselves unnecessary. The job of a rabbi is to make themselves superfluous. The job of a rabbi is to get somebody to the point that they no longer need them. Now, I will absolutely admit that I have totally failed in this by having, I don't know, how many of my students over the years, and literally I've taught tens of thousands of people, how many people over the years that I've taught have been able to say, okay, I whatever he can do, I can do that by myself, I don't need him. I don't know, I think I've totally failed on that level. But it's not the only level of having somebody be able to take a text, approach a text, and ask themselves, and by the way, I could to a certain extent do this in terms of the teachers that I've had. I can then take a text and say, what questions would they have asked? What answers would they have been satisfied with? What answers would they have rejected? Which means the purpose of a teacher is to make themselves not necessary. Let me start all over again. What's the purpose of a parent? The purpose of a parent is to get the child to the point that they no longer need the parent, to make them self-sufficient. At the point that a kid becomes self-sufficient, can make the decisions that their parents would have made for them without their parents staying there. Look, part of the purpose of coming to Israel for a year, or for that matter, leaving your home, is to be on your own and be able to make good decisions along the way. And you're able to do that. By the way, sometimes there's actually a process that takes place, and that is, okay, what would my mother, what would my father do in this case? Now, sometimes you have the luxury of being able to call them up and say, listen, I have this quandary, you know, what do you think? You have people that no longer have parents, but still, 20, 30 years later, they can say to themselves, again, just process, what would my father, what would my mother have done or said in this case? And then suddenly you get clarity along the way. The reason I'm saying all of this is because, I, again, how did I start this? The Jews grew up during the story of Purim. How so? At this point, there's no prophets, which in a sense is a punishment. Why is it a punishment? We didn't listen to prophets for so much time. The guy says, listen, you're not going to listen. I'm not going to bother telling you anymore. I'm not going to speak to you. So we're there far away from the land of Israel. We're in Shushan, and God is not speaking. So now, a nice girl named Esther, together with a little help perhaps from Mordechai, has to go and figure out what in the world does God want from her in this situation. Which means the Jews accepting the Torah in Shushan is not the same thing as accepting the Torah by Har Sinai. You accept the Torah at Sinai, you have total clarity. God is standing there on top of you. You have all the thunder and the lightning, and you know exactly what it is that you need to do, because God tells you what you need to do. Which means now the question is, are we going to survive as a people? Because now we grew up and we no longer have God telling us what to do. And now, if we can figure out how we continue, then we continue as a people. If we can't continue, we can't figure that out, then we failed. And by the way, I think on a certain level, this is really something I would say to any kid who's bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. What does it mean to grow up, right? What does it mean to be that a Jewish kid is an adult? So the joke is, a Jewish kid who grew up is when he realizes that there's a better chance that he can own an NBA team than play in the NBA, right? That means growing up. Today, there's a nice Jewish girl actually owns a football team, right? Right? A better chance a Jewish woman is going to own an NFL team than play in the NFL. They just won the Super Bowl. A nice Jewish girl owns the team. But that's a joke. Seriously, what does it mean to grow up? It means that you're on your own and you know the right thing to do because you've had enough education, which means you've become self-sufficient. The Jewish people became self-sufficient by the story of Purim because God didn't tell them what to do, and nonetheless they figured out what to do. And that's really part of the celebration of Purim, is that we grew up, we became mature, we finally have clarity. Which means this idea of getting clarity on Purim, which again, when I read the text the first time, that you have to drink until the point that you no longer know the difference between the two. At first glance, it sounds like Purim is about total confusion, but no. Purim is about clarity and understanding what we need to do, and I'm saying this on a national level, and that's the reason why we survived. That's really what accepting Torah is. It means that we survived as a people because now we knew how to move forward. And by the way, I think this is absolutely the challenge of Judaism in this generation, and for that matter, in any post-prophetic generation, that leaders, and sometimes leaders helped by people, and I want to stress that point, leaders, rabbis, sometimes have no idea what people are going through, and you need people to be telling them what they're going through in order for them to understand what it is that they need to be teaching about, be talking about, be ruling about, and giving psak about because of where the generation is. But if Judaism can't respond to what's going on in the world, then there's going to be a problem. Over here is when we became independent and we had to just sit and figure this out by ourselves. Listen, I'll speak on my own personal experience. I became a rabbi. I wasn't that old. I think I got smicha around the age of 24. Okay? I moved to a neighborhood where there was no rabbi there. There were a couple other people who were like me, who were young, who were learning for smicha, whether they had it or not. People would ask me questions. Now, if somebody asked me a question on a Tuesday, I would look it up. If I were really confident, I would tell them. But very often, I would call up one of my teachers or someone else and say, listen, this is what I was asked, this is what I answered, and this is what I think, you know. But what happens if somebody asks me on Shabbat and I can't call somebody up? So this happened once and a second and a tenth and a 20th and a third and enough times that all you could do then afterwards say, listen, this is a question somebody asked, this is the answer I gave. And when you see time after time after time that you're able to give an answer, so then you get a little bit more confidence. This is what happened to the Jewish people. They had to respond on a Shabbat without a telephone, they can't call, there's no one to talk to, and now what do I do to survive? So it means the Jews needed clarity. And that's why this text is so interesting. Read by itself, it sounds like you need to drink till you get total confusion. Now, there are Hasidic sources, like from the Arizal, Kabbalistic sources, like the Arizal, then moving over to some Hasidic sources who will understand everything over here on a straight off line. You need to drink to the point that you get to this total internal point of truth. And now the question is, what is that internal point by you? I need to try to explain that again. That you need to drink till you break down all of the static around, and that core individual should be a core individual that is this total love of God and understanding of truth. That is the way the Arizal understands it. Okay, the Arizal was an incredible tzaddik. So presumably, if the Arizal drank a little bit and you take away all of the inhibitions, what's left is this incredibly holy person, and that's what he felt that people should do on Purim. You drink, you take away the inhibitions, now people realize that incredible holiness which exists. The question is, are most of us on that level? So again, those who will say, yes, you need to drink on Purim and just take this at face value, that's the way they understand it. To get to this core who you are question, and it needs to be a person inside who's very, very holy. My suspicion is that most people in the world are not on that level. My suspicion is that most people in the world, if they drink to an extreme amount, they may not necessarily find themselves with a situation of total love and awe of God, and hopefully they do. It seems to me, I just want to go back to everything that we've seen and move towards a conclusion for today. It seems to me as follows. One, on a primary level, why does the Gemara speak about drinking? I think on a primary level, we're trying to figure out what is the nature of Purim in terms of a holiday. So therefore, there's a festive meal. Including the festive meal, there should be some wine. Even though there's no Kiddush, even though it's not a holy day, it should still have some wine to it. On the other hand, or maybe deeper behind this hand, is that the whole story of Purim is punctuated by drinking. There's drinking wine throughout the story, and therefore maybe drinking is the way to celebrate Purim because it's there all the way through the entire story. Okay. Drinking to the point that you cannot tell the difference between good and evil, that just seems absurd. We read our Agadah, which follows, that Rabbah gets up and kills Reb Zerah. For some, if you need a name for this, Rabbi Ephraim, for example, or Rabbeinu Ephraim says, oh, this proves, the story proves that Rav's teaching has been rejected. It proves you don't drink on Purim. Most people don't go in that direction, but a number of Rishonim did. Others say it can't mean it literally, and that's when they start moving to those other interpretations. It means the refrain of the song, you get confused in the refrain, you get confused in the gematria, you don't remember, or you contemplate, you think about what's really important in this world, rewarding good or punishing evil. But again, very, very few will take this on the level of a literal interpretation that you need to drink to the point that you can't tell there's good and evil. Those who do go in that direction will end up inevitably somehow getting back to the Garden of Eden, getting back to that original wine, getting back to that original sin, getting back to that original confusion, and then trying to recreate a world which will be a world with clarity, with accepting Torah. And that's another one of the themes of Purim. It's a theme of accepting Torah. One of the most remarkable teachings, and maybe I'll end with this, was one which I saw in the writings of somebody named Rav Huttner, called the Pachad Yitzchak. So what he writes there is, all the texts on Purim, or at least the texts that we've seen today, you understand one way when you're reading them before Purim, but then they have a whole new meaning on Purim. So he says that one of the things that happened by Matan Torah is that God is there, it's so intense, thunder and lightning. It says that everybody had a cardiac arrest and everybody died, and then God sprinkled some tal, some dew on them, and people came back to life. So he says part of receiving the Torah was that people just got overwhelmed. But Purim, we're told, I don't know if you know the Gemara. The Gemara says that this is called a moda rabba leraita, is that it was so overwhelming that we had no choice but accepting the Torah. They said, but we re-accepted the Torah when the story of Purim took place. Let me just explain that a little bit better, and then I'll tell you what Rav Huttner said. If somebody puts a gun to your head and says to you, you know, please sell me your computer, and you say, I don't want to sell my computer. So you put a gun to your head and say, I want to buy the computer. So you turn around somebody next to you and say, listen, I just want you, I'm doing this under duress. So I give you money, you give me the computer, you can then come to court and say, listen, you bring the witnesses, it was under duress. That's called a moda'a. You gave information to people that you're doing this under duress, it goes back, you get the money back, they get the money back, you get the computer back. So it says, but if God, the way that Matan Torah took place, the Gemara describes it as if God lifted up the mountain and said to us, either you accept the Torah or there will be your demise. So okay, we didn't have a choice. So what does it mean that God lifted the mountain? It was so overwhelming that we had no choice. So the Gemara then says, but this is a protest, then it's a moda. Say, no, if God didn't force us, we never would have accepted it. So the Gemara then says, no, they re-accepted it during the time of Purim. So what does that mean they re-accepted it? First of all, I could say as follows. We did accept the Torah. Why do we accept the Torah? Because God essentially said, you know, there's a deal. You want the land of Israel? You have to accept the Torah. What then happened? He kicked us out of the land of Israel. So at that point, we said, listen, we accepted this whole thing under false pretenses. We were forced into it. We, which means you said you're going to give us Israel, and we're supposed to follow the Torah. We didn't follow the Torah. We didn't accept. So the deal is off. But then we re-accepted the Torah at Purim. So what does re-accepting the Torah mean? It means that even though there is no thunder, there's no lightning, there's no prophet, there's no God standing on top of us, but we accept it as, that's why I said the Jewish people grew up then, we accepted the Torah during the story of Purim with no duress, with anything else, and that is the people that we are today, is accepting the Torah without prophets, without leverage, without God making us an offer that we can't refuse, as we used to say back in Brooklyn. So Rav Huttner then said that accepting the Torah is something which is so overwhelming that they all died because of the God standing there. So he says that's what Rabbah and Rav Zera experienced, that they totally accept the Torah, and they came to this realization that the hand of God was there. The hand of God did reward good. The hand of God did punish evil. That God is involved, and they're behind the scenes and hidden, and therefore the acceptance of the Torah there was so overwhelming. When you accept the Torah, that was the point of death and coming back to life again. So that's how Rav Huttner says, you can't understand what he just now said all year round. He says you can only understand this teaching on Purim. So you can try it and see if you understand it on Purim. At the end of the day, you know what would I advise? I would advise celebrating Purim, having a happy Purim. Everybody should know themselves. As far as drinking goes, people should drink a little more than they usually drink, which is a very dangerous thing for me to say to people who are 18 years old. But people should drink out of service of God, drink out of love of God, drink out of celebrating, and drinking out of the sense of maturity as a people, that even though I don't see God, I don't hear God, I'm like the kid who finally grew up. I know what my parents want me to do, or I know what my teacher was really teaching me there along the line. I don't need them in front of me to be able to make that good decision, and that's what it means to grow up. That's what the Jewish people did. We became a mature people, and that's part. And I think that's really what the celebration of Purim is. If you get to this point of total confusion, then you'll be fixing some very, very profound things. But remember that the drinking itself is part of the celebration, is part of the avoda, it's part of really the service of God. And if you constantly realize that the drinking is the serving of God, then hopefully you shouldn't get confused at all. Quite the opposite, maybe you'll even get to some clarity. I know, no questions. By the way, how many of you actually speak English as a native? Just wondering. Okay, if there are questions, let me know. Otherwise, send me a text later so I know that you were here.